Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Christian Sager, and we're going to be talking about a great combination of things today. Isolation tanks, dolphins, and psychedelics.
Yeah, the creature from the Black Lagoon will actually show up. Cold War era anti-espionage, weird science. It's quite a package.
You couldn't make this up. Like, if you wrote a fictional account of a guy like John C. Lilly, it would seem absurd. But this is a life he led.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, even the fictionalized accounts of the man, I feel they don't quite capture the weirdness and strangeness and just mind-expanding awesomeness of his actual story.
They don't, no. So, but before we roll right in, because I think we should really just dive into the deep end, no pun intended, with John C. Lilly, we just want to remind our audience that, you know, we don't just do the podcast. Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a multimedia conglomerate, and you can visit us at stufftoblowyourmind.com, where you can find blog posts by us. The podcast is obviously there, of course, but for every podcast episode, we add related content. So in case you're curious about learning more, there's places that you can go. And then we also do videos as well.
That's right. And hey, wherever you listen to us, be it iTunes or Spotify or any of the various wonderful platforms out there, you can support the show by simply giving us a positive rating and a positive review if the platform allows that kind of interaction.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll say is before we get into Lilly is don't forget to follow us on social media. If you're on Facebook, you're on Twitter, you're on Tumblr, we're on all those platforms as Blow the Mind. And we don't only post our own stuff, but we curate lots of weird, sciencey, bizarre, oddity type stuff that we find throughout the day as we're doing our research.
That's right.
So let's talk about Lilly. First of all, why are we covering him? Because Lilly, for people who don't know, comes up frequently. I'd say in the last year of doing the show, he's come up at least four or five times.
Yeah, and in past episodes, I know that we have had at least three episodes that have dealt with him, at least in small portions.
Right, yeah. You guys did a dolphin episode. You and Julie did a dolphin episode. And then there was the like kind of crazy rock star life of scientists?
Yeah. We did one that was just kind of a sampler platter of different real life scientists that had sort of a weird side to them. But Lilly is one of those individuals, first of all, that, as we've been saying, deserves a deeper dive. He deserves a closer look because he was into too many things. He really lived too many lives to just try and condense it to a quick little segment about his psychedelic dolphin research, which is what most people may think of when we mention John C. Lilly.
This is one of those moments, too, where I feel like the podcast format is really at an advantage here because In our case, you know, like lots of the stuff that I've read about Lilly, like you said, either focuses on one aspect of his work or another, right? It's like, it's either like the isolation tanks or it's just the dolphins. But I feel like we have the opportunity here to like gather a lot of different resources, come together and kind of try to piece it all together and figure out this like epic figure somehow. And especially the like you said too, like, for those of you who don't know, there's been two feature films, at least two, that were, made based on Lilly as a character. The first was Day of the Dolphin with George C. Scott. And then the second one is, Altered States, of course, which is, you know, we're huge fans of here. And it stars William Hurt, you know, of course, as this Lilly kind of figure who takes acid in isolation tanks and then finds himself devolving basically, right, into various forms of proto-humanity.
Yeah. So he's a figure that casts a large shadow across our popular culture. And I think that can also be a stumbling block because you might think of that older, John C. Lilly, kind of a post, hippie nut job with a, with a coonskin cap, talking about expanded consciousness and perhaps being something of a pariah, to individuals who are working in legitimate scientific areas that he was once a part of.
Yeah, there were certainly people who did not embrace the direction that he went in towards the latter part of his career. But so this is what's interesting to me about him, especially like once we got into, I knew the surface level stuff, but going back and looking at his early life and how he started off and how kind of standardized his scientific career was to begin with, it's really fascinating to see where he goes and the kind of journey that he takes everybody on.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, this is a guy that was trained in medicine, psychoanalysis, biophysics, and he went from being published as a researcher in scientific journals to writing his own books about spirituality and the self.
And one of the things that's really important about Lilly, I think, to just like our general culture today, it's hard to think of this because it's for my entire life it's been this way, but people didn't used to think of dolphins as being intelligent mammals that were cute and cuddly and that we should try to keep from being killed in the ocean, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you go back far enough, there are various myths that involve humans turning into dolphins or vice versa. But generally speaking, before the 1950s, dolphins were a pest to fishermen. They were a fatty creature you might render down for various products. But nobody was giving a lot of thought to what they were thinking or indeed what their consciousness might consist of.
Yeah, and so almost every account that I read about Lilly traces his research with dolphins to how we treat dolphins today.
Yeah.
Even to, you know, good or bad, however you think of it, of like theme parks of like SeaWorld and things like that. But like, the interaction that human beings have with dolphins or other mammals in the water, like whales, you know, in that kind of a setting, you know, he really changed the way that we considered them as, I guess, partners on Earth is how he would probably put it, right?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine where we'd be right now, considering dolphin intelligence without Lilly. I mean, I think we would definitely get to this point where we recognize the intelligence of the dolphin, and even engage in discussions about its potential personhood.
Yeah.
But, would we have gotten there as quickly? Would we have gotten there with as much media attention?
And it all really came down to him wanting to map human consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, the dolphin work, the isolation tanks, taking LSD, all of it really boiled back to his medical background and just trying to figure out like the physicality of human consciousness, where it was.
Yeah, he and later on, certainly by the 1970s, he would often talk about the province of the mind, which we reference in the title to this episode.
Yeah, so here's the Lilly quote that comes from, you know, what we base the title in the episode from. He says, "In the province of the mind, what one believes to be true is true or becomes true, with certain limits to be found experientially and experimentally. These limbs are further beliefs to be transcended. In the mind, there are no limits." That was in 1972. So this was post dolphin work going into LSD work, I'm assuming.
Yeah. And I think it's a great quote because it mentions this idea of the province of the mind, something that all of his work throughout his life, as you mentioned, seems to be questing for. And then it also touches on this idea of subjective truth, which becomes an increasingly important part of his work and at times a definite flaw in his scientific work.
Right, yeah. And it's especially important to consider, too. I mean, like we say his whole life here. I read an account that when he was 16 years old, he was first starting to think about this in journals and things like that he was working on. Like, as a kid, this was something that concerned Lilly up until his death.
Yeah. So let's back up a bit then and just deal with the Lilly timeline. Let's talk about where he came from and take listeners and ourselves on a journey through his life, or as much of it as we can actually digest in about an hour's time.
Yeah, and I'll say this too before we get into it. I found that there were a lot of differing accounts too. I mean, he was alive at just the right moment in time where it wasn't like we couldn't log his life as we do now with social media. You know what I mean? And there's like some differing accounts. So like I said, when he's 16 years old, he supposedly wrote this essay. He was born in 1915 in St. Paul, Minnesota. And this is the specific a question that was quoted as being the title of his essay. How can the mind render itself sufficiently objective to study itself? That's pretty heady for a 16-year-old. I don't think I had thoughts like that until much later.
Yeah, he was thinking big for that age.
Really? Yeah. Unless that's some like revisionist history on his part. But, the other thing that I thought was really interesting is my impression from the readings is that Lilly came from a very wealthy family, I think. Mm-hmm. And his father, it sounds like, wanted him to become a banker, but Lilly wanted to be a scientist. And so eventually his father kind of came around and supported him going to school to study science, but also backed him financially in some of his research after school as well.
Yeah, that's the sense that I get from some of the resources we were looking at. And I do have to mention that as far as we know, there's not a good, like, solid, concise biography Lilly out there. Not yet. Hopefully somebody's working on it. There are some very fine resources that we used for this episode, and we'll cite those as we go.
Yeah, this is a book/movie dying to be made.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think that, like, in the same way that characters like Reich that we've talked about on the show before, Shulgin, just make for great, like, potential fictionalizations. And I think, you know, I just learned this after we recorded the Reich episode. There's a feature film coming out about Reich.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was searching for artwork for it, photos from the premiere came out.
All right, so Lilly goes on. He gets his physics degree from Caltech in 1938, receives a doctorate in medicine from the University of Pennsylvania in 1942. And as a faculty member, he studies biophysics and psychoanalysis at the University of Pennsylvania and is primarily interested in the physical structures of the brain where the conscious self might be found.
So that's pretty interesting in that, like, he got his doctorate in medicine, right? And then he continues to do research or take classes as well as he's a faculty member. Like, my understanding was the psychoanalysis stuff wasn't quite yet in the field when he was in school, but he's still dabbling and learning more and adding everything to his resume.
Yeah, from an early point, we're seeing a guy who has this goal in mind, this mystery that he wants to crack, and he's going to throw everything he has at it.
Yeah.
And he's going to utilize whatever tools he can draw on, be they disciplines, pharmaceuticals, technologies. We see this throughout his life.
Yeah, and in some cases, it's also like where he's going to get the support from, right? I think all of us who have like large-scale creative endeavors that we're trying to push and can't find necessarily the financial backing end up making compromises. And come World War II, Lilly ends up doing research mainly, it sounds like, on the physiology of high altitude flying, specifically for the Air Force. And, he was inventing different devices to measure gas pressure for those purposes. And this is one of the first times, apparently, that he used himself as a guinea pig. Lilly, which he would go on to do quite a bit later in his career. In fact, I think he had sort of like an ethos surrounding that, right? That I can't remember who it was, but I read that he took this from another, like, kind of big thinker scientist who basically said, like, if you're not willing to experiment on yourself, then you shouldn't be willing to experiment on other human beings. And this seems to be the case here, where he participated in an experiment where he was studying the effects of explosive decompression on pilots at high altitudes. And by all accounts that I read, this was something that could have killed him.
Huh.
but he went about and did it anyways. And this is in the 30s going into the 40s.
All right. So after the war, we're getting into the post-World War II area. We're getting into the 1950s, a time increasingly defined by Cold War paranoia. It's during this area that Lilly turns to neuroscience, which is a logical next step in this quest for consciousness, right? And he's motivated in a large part by pioneering brain surgeon Wilder Penfield at this point. In short, what he ends up doing is he applies electronic engineering to the monitoring and mapping of the central nervous system. Again, drawing on the best technology available at the time to try and crack this nut of consciousness.
Yeah, and what I had read, this is one of the first instances of his father funding him. His father helped him pay for the design of something he called the Bavatron, which was a device for recording the impulses from within a rabbit's brain. And they would project these impulses up onto like a television screen as waves. So the Bavatron included an array of sensors that were, this is something we're going to come back to over and over again with Lilly, basically putting electrodes on the surface of the brain of different animals and or human beings. And in 1951, he published a paper that showed how to display these patterns in such a way, projecting brain electrical activity on a television-like screen. And I recently spent some time in the hospital. I had a family member in ICU, and I thought, wow, like think of the standard hospital machinery we have that are like measuring and showing us things like oxygen levels breathing and brain activity. You know, Lilly was one of the pioneers in that. You can thank him for that. This is a guy who really did like impact our understanding of medicine and of thought and, despite where he went down further in his career, he really did have like some contributions.
Yeah. Down or out.
Or out,
You want to look at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
From here, he moves on to the National Institutes of Mental Health, or NIM. And this is an area where he begins to get into a lot of interesting and at times kind of creepy work.
Yeah, and I read an interesting thing that said that one of the reasons why he specifically went for this research position with NIM was that it gave him access to both the National Institute of Neurological Diseases, because that would give him access to resources about the physical brain, but it also gave him access to the National Institute of Mental Health, which focused on the mind. And he really wanted to combine the two. And he experimented on living brains with all these different techniques he developed. So, you know, we've got the rabbits, we talked about that, but then he moved on to monkeys. His goal was to stimulate monkey brains without causing trauma or damage to their brain tissue. So he was one of the first scientists to locate, this is a monkey brain, not a human brain, obviously, but he located their pain and pleasure centers. And his work there allowed him to map their neural networks and to link sensory events, muscle movement, and other behaviors related to the activity in their brain. This is going to be important later on when we get into dolphins.
Yeah, and this is, my understanding, it's pretty invasive surgery at this point and experimentation. Yeah. And he spends essentially a decade working on it here. Again, conducting invasive vivisections of the cranium. And this is where things get into some creepier territory. Again, he's laser focused on his goal, but he is in the ploy of NIM. He's working in the time of 1950s Cold War paranoia. It's us versus the Soviets. There are all these fears of mind control, brainwashing, all sorts of strange counter-espionage techniques. And according to D. Graham Burnett's excellent paper, A Mind in Water, which was published in Orion magazine and is available online, we'll include a link to it on the landing page, he says, Lilly later claimed not to care for this sort of thing, but in his prime as a government employee, he had high-level security clearance. J. Edgar Hoover knew him by name and was actively involved in research into brainwashing, or reprogramming, as it was then called among the cognoscenti.
Yeah.
Sleep deprivation and operant controlled. Of animals with wires implanted in the pain centers of their gray matter, unquote.
Wow. So this gets back to when we were talking about We Three on the animal weaponry thing. So, yeah, I can imagine with all the things we learned from that episode of like people stuffing bats into bombs and trying to figure out ways to use bees to attack people that, of course, they would be looking at ways to try to stimulate their brains as well, right?
And the goal here was not just animals, but humans. In an unpublished paper, of Lilly's titled Special Considerations of Modified Human Agents as Reconnaissance and Intelligence Devices. I really don't have to go much further than that. Just go by the title. But he talked about such things as the, quote, covert and relatively safe implantation of electrodes into the human brain for the push-button control of the totality of motivation and of consciousness.
Huh. I wonder how much Lilly's sort of, like, beginning work set the stage for brain-computer interface work, you know, that's being studied today. Because that's obviously, mm-hmm. like, a big field of inquiry right now.
Yeah, I mean, to whatever extent his ideas here were actually applicable, given the technology of the time, and he's certainly foreshadowing where the technology would go. He's certainly dreaming in the direction that we're still headed.
So one of the things that I was trying to figure out while we were doing the research was whether or not these were pain-free methods. And I believe later in his career, he definitely wanted to get to a point, right? Like I mentioned earlier that, mm-hmm. you know, his goal was not to cause trauma in the monkeys and not to damage their brain tissue. But I imagine it wasn't comfortable having these electrodes stuck in their brains, right?
Yeah, my understanding, it also depended on what he was working on. So you could use anesthetics on certain animals.
Yeah.
But as we'll discuss, there are other animals that simply stop breathing if you put them under an anesthetic.
Right, yeah. And there's always there's a very interesting, like, despite his profound respect for dolphins later on, there's some weird stuff that goes on with the dolphin research as well, too, in terms of, like, kind of treating them humanely.
Yeah, and certainly at this point in his career, he's a very unsentimental guy.
Yeah.
He's laser-focused on this consciousness enigma. But he's not necessarily, he's certainly not the sort of hippie, mythic figure, counterculture figure we see later on. Quite the opposite. Yeah. This is a guy who's on first name basis with J. Edgar Hoover. He's very
right.
much a part of the establishment and kind of a scary part of the establishment.
Yeah, and he is gonna do what needs to be done to get the results.
Right. So, it's during this creepy period that Lilly first learns from an oceanographer colleague that the largest brains are found in small-toothed whales. Intrigued, he sets out to implant electrodes in the brains of captive dolphins at Florida's Marine Studios. Now, this place still exists today under the name Marineland of Florida. Perhaps some of our listeners have been there and can speak to it. But at the time, they specialized in B-movies.
Really?
Of particular note, they shot The Creature from the Black Lagoon, 1954 here, and Revenge of the Creature from 1955.
Wow. So John C. Lilly was, like, peripherally involved with, like, Universal horror, specifically The Creature from the Black Lagoon. I think you might have mentioned this before the podcast. How cool would it be for there to be like a Creature of the Black Lagoon remake that like mixes in some of the John C. Lilly ideas of, you know, both dolphin human communication, but also isolation tanks and hallucinogenics?
Yeah. I mean, and in fact, we'll get back to the Creature from the Black Lagoon in a minute because the connection between Lilly and the creature is even closer than you might be thinking now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. So he engages in this work, right? He's putting the electrodes on the dolphins' brains. One of the problems here, as I mentioned, is that dolphins stop breathing when they're under anesthetic.
Mm.
And this has to do with the conscious nature of dolphin respiration. So it's not as much of a subconscious activity as it is for us surface dwellers.
Right.
So it's pretty rough work. Dolphins are dying during the experiments. But one of them, before it passes, makes a series of sounds, and Lilly has this epiphany. He's listening to the sound that this dolphin is making. It sounds as if they're attempting to mimic his voice. They're attempting to mimic the voice of the other researchers in the room, and it's just this eureka moment for him.
Yeah.
He's been searching for consciousness, searching for some sort of, you know, ultimately connection to another mind, and he feels as if he has glimpsed it.
So this is sort of a good segue, I guess, then, from his dolphin, or actually, this isn't even the really scratching the surface of his dolphin research, right?
Right.
This is where he first sort of dabbles in it.
Yeah, this is where, he dabbles in it, and the light bulb goes off, and he realizes, I have to work with these dolphins. Everything else I'm just gonna walk away from because this is where I need to be.
And then in order to facilitate this type of study, he invents the isolation tank, which most of us know nowadays, right? Because it's a fairly popularized thing. I was first familiar with it from Altered States. That was the first time I'd ever heard of it. I think I probably saw Altered States when I was like 19 or 20 or something like that. But, just last year, maybe 2 years ago, my wife for my birthday got me a gift card to go visit an isolation tank center here in Atlanta.
Oh yeah. I think we've likely been to the same place.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. You've done it as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. For those of you who are not familiar with it, you can probably find a float place in your area. You can try it out for yourself. But essentially, it is a dark chamber filled with very buoyant salt water.
Yeah.
You go in there, maybe you put on some goggles, maybe you're wearing a bathing suit, maybe not.
Yeah.
And you're just floating there in the silence. All you're hearing is just the sound of the water, the sound of your own heartbeat.
Because you're floating, you don't really sense any touch, right? It's, mm-hmm. which is unusual for us. We're always like kind of bound to something by gravity, but this allows you to kind of just float there. The darkness takes away your eyesight for the most part. The one I was in kind of, I don't know about you, but it had like a little bit of a transparency to it. So natural daylight kind of came in. And then there was, what was the other? Oh, they gave me earplugs. Did you get earplugs?
I may have gotten earplugs. I can't remember. Okay. Now, I do remember seeing lights eventually because I think I was in darkness. And I also have to say that the warmness of the water tends to be calibrated so that...
It's about human body temperature, right?
Yeah, so that it's, in a way, the barriers of your body are no longer as obvious. So mm-hmm. it's about isolating the mind. And
yeah.
apparently, like, the idea for this came out of Lily's work at NIM. Again, think back to the counter-espionage work.
Right.
How do you break down a potential spy? How do you break into their mind and interact with their consciousness? Well, what if you were to put a scary latex mask over their face so they can't see anything, mm-hmm. submerge them in this buoyant tank of salt water, and just rob them of their senses without actually harming them?
Yeah.
So really it was a form of psychological torture that was being devised. And it was apparently pretty traumatic for some of the individuals who tested it out. But of course, Lily tested it out as well.
Yep.
And he saw the positive potential for the kind of inward focus that it allowed.
Yeah. I mean, the basic idea here was he wanted to test whether the brain would actually shut down if there was no stimuli received, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's really interesting. Again, so like the figure that he becomes, this kind of hippie psychedelic guru figure, you trace back his history and it's like ultimately connected to this kind of movement of torture and interrogation, right? I mean, like, I don't know that they're necessarily using isolation tanks, but sensory deprivation is very much a thing that we do nowadays. We, the United States military and government, when we're trying to get information out of, somebody that might have something that's going to, you know, potentially affect a citizen or an operation overseas.
Oh, yeah, or even just dishing out essentially punishment on individuals that are in solitary confinement.
Yeah, this is fascinating to me too, because this is right around, it's a little bit earlier, but around the same time that Michel Foucault is really starting to look into sort of the philosophy of discipline and punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really curious if these two guys knew about each other and if they even, or if they interacted too, you know.
Yeah, indeed. So Lily, yeah, really gets into the idea of the isolation tank. And this is kind of happening, in the background to the dolphin stuff, we just mentioned, the beginnings of the dolphin stuff. I'm gonna actually just read, one quote from him and have you read another one,
okay.
Because I think Lily really, captures what he saw in the tank, what he saw in the tank's potential for the human mind. He said, "All the average person has to do is get into the tank in the darkness and silence and float around until he realizes he is programming everything that is happening inside his head. You are free of the physical world at that point, and anything can happen inside your head because everything is governed by the laws of thought rather than the laws of the external world. So you can go to the limits of your conceptions."
And so this is a good moment, I think, for us to sort of back up for the listener, for you out there listening. If you've never done this and you've never seen it depicted or read about it, people oftentimes report that during their experience in these tanks, they see colorful images, they have memories flash by, they kind of have like waking dreams, and there's even There's an, some people reported an experience of levels of consciousness where they feel they're in contact with other intelligent beings sort of outside of them, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's essentially a really meditative space. So I only floated once. I did not get that kind of experience. I understand that one needs to do it many times to get used to it. But I have had experiences in meditation where I have seen things and felt things that, that line up to a certain extent with this kind of, you know, subjective experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible to, so this is another instance that I, where the, like, the reporting seems to be a little bit, varied for me.
Mm-hmm.
I read that it's possible that he actually started dabbling in this before any of the dolphin research. Maybe it was more official later on.
Yeah, no, I believe you're right on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because he apparently considered dolphins and other, water mammals because of the idea of consciousness that existed in the state of flotation.
Right.
And he, it somehow brought that up. But, so here's another thing. We were talking about how you bring the temperature to about the same as the body's temperature. Apparently at one point while Lily was experimenting on himself, he's trying to bring the temperature to the right thing and he fell into a coma. That was another thing that I read.
Huh.
And I mean, it must not have been that long or serious, but I don't quite know how that would happen even, especially given my experience in an isolation tank, but this was in one of the papers I read. He also speculated, now this is the beginning of the John C. Lilly everybody came to know and love, that in a tank, a person, meaning a man, could orgasm without ejaculating.
Hmm.
So another thing that comes out of this outside of his like speculations of on orgasms and ejaculation is that he also figured out that even in the tank, that the pure mental state that he was looking to achieve wasn't necessarily possible because it even eliminating all sensory stimulation, it, just that kind of isolation in the tank wasn't achieving that.
Right.
This is probably a good opportunity for me to read that second quote you mentioned. So this is from, Lilly wrote lots of books on his own outside of his work with the government and that weren't published really by, I wouldn't call them peer reviewed in any sense. Right. And this was one of them. I believe it's called, I love this title, Tanks for the Memories, Flotation Tank Talks.
Yeah. And this is from 95. So this is definitely later.
This is after. Yeah. So, okay. He says, at the highest level of Satori from which people return, the point of consciousness becomes a surface or a solid which extends throughout the whole known universe. This used to be called fusion with the universal mind or God. In more modern terms, you have done a mathematical transformation in which your center of consciousness has ceased to be a traveling point and has become a surface or solid of consciousness. It was in this state that I experienced myself as melded and intertwined with hundreds of billions of other beings in a thin sheet of consciousness that was distributed around the galaxy, a membrane. Now, this definitely touches on some of his wackier theories that we're going to get into later.
Yeah, it touches on some more, the mystical ideas that he explores in his work. I do have to say, though, with ultimately what he's talking about here and ultimately with the experience of both meditation but also with the float tank, a lot of what's happening is the shutdown of what's called the default mode network.
Right.
Actually, we understand it more now as a series of interconnected resting state networks involved in vision, hearing, movement, attention, and memory. But you can think of it as just that me voice, what Eckhart Tolle calls the egoic mind, this sort of me-centered narrative that's always running in the background of our head, whether we are conscious of it or not, worrying about the past, worrying about the future. And if you can shut that off, then you're in this point of clarity and nowness, and you can actually explore thoughts about yourself and the world around you in ways that you're often crippled from.
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly like what I try to get out of, with yoga and meditation in some situations. But also, I got to say, after doing the isolation tank thing, I want one of those in my home. And maybe if you did it too much, it would sort of defeat the purpose for achieving that sort of lack of self, right? Of thinking about everything else around you.
I don't know. I've never heard anyone say they do it too much.
They're
always, the people who are really into it are really.
If I could just like after every day coming home, just hop into one of those for 30 minutes, that would be great. I read an account about there was a woman in the 1980s who was apparently like a, I don't know that I would call her a student of Lilly's, but she was somebody who followed his work closely. Uh-huh. And she was one of the first people to open like a business around isolation tanks. And she had one in her home on the 25th floor of a Manhattan skyscraper. And she, I think at the time she charged people like $25 per hour. And one of her main clients was a television executive who would, he said something along the lines of how like after every flight home back to Manhattan, after like, you know, doing a bunch of television sales type stuff, he would, before even going home, go to her place and hop into one of these isolation tanks. It's kind of fascinating that like a guy like that saw the value in just kind of slowing everything down.
Yeah. I mean, he leads a busy life, so it would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you, here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. So let's, at this point, we're going to return back to dolphins. I feel like we've set everything up to continue Lily's journey. We're going to around 1958. This is when Lily presents a paper before the American Psychiatric Association, and he makes some rather dramatic claims about the intelligence and the linguistic abilities of the bottlenose dolphin specifically. Now that the evidence that he cites is apparent, is arguably scant and anecdotal, but it resonated pretty strongly, and it resonated with the right people. So soon you had prestigious federal research awards rolling in, and he uses these funds to build a dedicated dolphin laboratory on St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands, the Communication Research Institute, or CRI.
Yeah, and the most fascinating thing that you added to these notes is that at its height, this institute, under Lilly's guidance, was receiving $500,000 a year in grant money.
Yeah, it exploded.
Crazy, yeah. Especially when you consider what $500,000 was worth back then.
Right.
That's nuts. That he was getting that much support. And it sounds like during this time, I guess he had a home in Miami. It sounded like he'd become fairly acclimated to Florida and liked it a lot there. But he had the lab in St. Thomas. And there was this really interesting 1960 Time magazine piece that I was able to pull. And it's this kind of fascinating, like, feature piece on him. And they describe him as a deep-chested, suntanned neurophysiologist. I like that. That must be where the idea for the George C. Scott character in Day of the Dolphin came from. But at the time that they came to visit him, Time magazine, that is, he was working on an elaborate system of jetties and pools at the center. And the idea was that he was trying to learn about dolphin sonar for the Navy. They were paying for the expenses of this construction. And the idea was that they felt that dolphin sonar was better than their own capabilities at the time. So they wanted to figure out a way to reverse engineer it and mimic it.
Yes, the Navy was definitely one of the interested parties that was won over by his arguments for dolphin intelligence and dolphin abilities.
Well, I mean, he had some convincing evidence. Like you said, it wasn't all like perfect, but when he must have been a very charismatic guy, I'm imagining.
Oh, yes.
Because when he gives these presentations, people just fall head over heels for it.
I mean, you hear it in his voice, and you'll actually hear his voice at the end of this podcast.
Like one of the things that I think he convinced the Navy with was by dissecting dolphin brains. You know, we talked about this earlier. They're bigger than human brains, obviously, but they also have as complicated a cerebral cortex. And so this is when he starts planting electrodes in the dolphin brains, kind of along the same lines of what we were talking about with the monkeys earlier, trying to stimulate their pleasure centers specifically with electricity. And this is the weirdest, like, this grossed me out, this quote from the Time magazine article. He said, when he first stimulated their pleasure centers with electrodes, the muscles around their blowhole smiled. That is the weirdest, like, I don't know why it just squicks me out, like the idea of a little smile forming around. And the dolphins got like its head peeled, you know, its scalp peeled back with all these electrodes wired into it. Whatever the case, the dolphins loved it. In fact, there was an apparatus that he used to sort of train them with it. They could give themselves the electrical jolt, and they did it so much that they became addicted to it. And this is a different story from what you mentioned earlier. In this 1960 piece, they say this is where he first encountered the dolphins mimicking human speech. He says that apparently, and maybe he's just, you know, BSing them during an interview or something like
right.
that. But he says an apparatus broke down one day at the St. Thomas laboratory, and he had left a tape recorder running. And he heard a Donald Duck-like voice on the tape recorder later on that was imitating him, saying the words 323 over and over again. And then he also said that the dolphins imitated the buzz of a transformer and the rattle of a movie camera that were in the, I'm assuming, in the same laboratory space.
Yeah, so there's this feeling that he's getting here that not only is he reaching out to them to make communication,
yeah.
but they are reaching out to us. And he has to meet them in the middle. He has to find a way to make this connection.
Mm-hmm. And towards that end, he starts like documenting what he thinks is dolphin language. And, you know, I think that it's fairly well documented at this point that we know that there is such a thing. He learned one phrase in dolphin language that he reported back to Time in 1960, and it was what he called their Mayday distress call. Mm-hmm. And he describes it as sounding like a wolf whistling, which I don't know that that's necessarily a description that immediately calls a sound to my mind, but maybe Lily was encountering more wolves than I do on a daily basis. But he specifically noted that this happened when he put a paralyzed dolphin in a pool. So one thing I want to stop and ask is, why would you do that? He puts this paralyzed dolphin in the pool, right? The dolphin sinks to the bottom and immediately starts crying out with this Mayday distress call. Well, Lily says the other dolphins all came to its rescue and pushed it back to the surface so that it could continue breathing. Hmm. So maybe he speculated that that was going to happen, and this was just kind of a test of their, I guess, like bond together.
Yeah.
But it just, again, I was like, wow, like... despite his fascination and love for these animals, he's willing to like let one potentially drown.
Yeah. And I mean, part of this, I think, is that he's certainly working, you know, within the scientific atmosphere of the day and the attitude towards, test animals of the day. And, you know, you can probably chalk a bit of it up to his, you know, his laser-focused vision, which we certainly saw during his NIMH days.
Yeah.
And continues to a certain extent with the dolphins. It sounds from the research I was reading that his work with the dolphins definitely got less invasive. He got further and further away from the sort of the harder stuff of the NIMH days. But he was still at times sort of accused of having an occasional cavalier attitude towards the test dolphins.
Yeah, I think though that sort of phases out over time.
Yeah,
you know. But not a year later after this Time thing, that's when he published his like big dolphin book, right?
Yes, 1961, Man and Dolphin: Adventures of a New Scientific Frontier, and this book just really becomes a big deal. Not only researchers, not only scientists and academics, but just the general public are eating this book up. And I'm just going to read you a quick sample from it so you can get just an idea of some of the things he's talking about in this book. He's documenting his work with dolphins thus far, but he's also talking about where he thinks this work can take us. He said, quote, "Eventually it may be possible for humans to speak with another species. I have come to this conclusion after careful consideration of evidence gained through my research experiments with dolphins. If new scientific developments are to be made in this direction, however, certain changes in our basic orientation and philosophy will be necessary." Mm-hmm. So he's talking about just a game-changing development here. He's talking about, he discusses us reaching the point where we teach dolphins to speak English.
Yeah.
And to even have to create a chair for them on the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is talking about finding an alien intelligence here on our planet and communing with them, communicating with them, and actually inviting them into our rule of the world.
And he's clearly going into his own soul searching too, if we sort of like compare this with the history of his life. You know, I mean, I think he had like a very personal reason for feeling so strongly about this, given the way that he had experimented on these animals previously. He goes from that to thinking that they should be part of the United Nations. By the 60s, this is when he's publishing academic papers galore, showing that dolphins can mimic all kinds of human speech patterns by clicking, squeaking, and rasping. And he even talked, there's this British, I got the impression from the article I read that this British anthropologist was a big deal at the time. His name was Gregory Bateson.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. Navy and him and Lily were all kind of influenced by the research that was going on at the center, and Lily pitched human-dolphin communication to NASA at the time, saying that if they were going to encounter aliens, this is the perfect way for them to sort of come up with a model of communication standards with an alien intelligence.
Yeah, and it makes sense, right? If you're attempting to communicate with a different yet equal form of consciousness.
Yeah.
This could conceivably be an experiment in that.
And you can see now where Day of the Dolphin came from. I don't know what year that came out. I want to say it was early 70s maybe, but if you've never seen the movie before, it involves the George C. Scott as John C. Lilly. Oh, they both had C's in the middle. Character teaching dolphins to speak English. They can speak English, and I believe it's on behalf of the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they say things like, Fa loves Pa, right? Like,
oh, yeah, because he's Pa.
He's Pa, and I think he names them all things that rhyme with Pa because it's easier for them to pronounce or whatever. Huh. It's kind of a silly movie, but it's also a little bit touching in a way.
So, yeah, the book is a huge success. It inspires these movies. It's, the idea just spreads like wildfire. And this was a period, again, the 50s and 60s, during which fascination with the underwater world is really taking off. This is the time of, you know, scuba is really, really exploding. Jacques Cousteau is making a big name for himself.
Yeah.
It's the time of Sea Hunt. And in 1963, of course, you see the television show Flipper.
Oh, yeah.
A mainstream television show about an intelligent dolphin that communicates with humans.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is where we come back to our connections to the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Oh, yeah. Hit me with it.
Okay. Yeah. So, I kind of had forgotten this, but that TV series Flipper was based on a 1963 film of the same name.
Okay.
A film co-created by Raku Browning.
Okay.
Raku Browning worked at Marine Studios, which we mentioned earlier, the place where Lilly initially went down to study dolphins. And Browning actually portrayed the creature from the Black Lagoon in the first two films.
Oh.
So Lilly is actually...
He was the guy wearing the rubber suit?
Yeah, he was the guy in the rubber suit in the first two creature films.
Wow, okay.
And again, he co-created Flipper, and Lilly is actually thanked in the credits to the 1963 film Flipper. So
that's nuts.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Well, yeah, and it also makes me think of... God, the film version of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was made around that time too, probably, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the specific date on that, but yeah, there is that fascination with sort of undersea adventure.
Yeah, it's opening up to us in ways that it just had not been previously available. And so we're fascinated with this new world down there. And then to also have this potential revelation laid on our plate that there is an intelligence down there, more or less on par with our own.
I wonder what John C. Lilly thought of the abyss.
I don't know.
That would have been interesting, huh?
Yeah, that's probably, in a way, that's a very Lilly movie, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, studies at the center continue. Again, Lilly's approach gradually moves away from the sort of the creepy world of NIM, his NIM work, and into less invasive techniques. He abandons the use of electrodes and instead attempts to essentially meld minds with the dolphins. To understand the shape of their consciousness, he turns increasingly to the flotation tank and attempt to achieve this.
Okay.
He pipes in hydrophone recordings of their sounds. And eventually, too, he starts using LSD.
And this is where it's all coming together. Right?
Yeah.
Like they seem like very disparate things when you say dolphins, isolation tanks, and LSD, but he's combining all of these things together.
Yeah, and at the time, it's legal. He's able to get it through his connections, his clearance. He's getting it totally on the board. And beginning in 1964, he also is injecting it into the dolphins to see what kind of effect it will have.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Really?
And this was pretty standard for the time. This was a time when there were a lot of LSD experiments going on, and we were putting LSD into the bodies of various animals and test subjects to see how they responded. And apparently, they did not really respond to LSD, which he was kind of disappointed with. But he kept taking it. He kept going into the tank.
Of course he did. Yeah.
To see if he could understand their mind.
So one of the things that I read when researching him, and I hadn't really realized this, do you remember a video game called Echo the Dolphin?
Yeah, I do.
I vaguely remember it. I didn't play it. I talked to Joe about it, our co-host, and he did play it. And apparently the whole game was centered around Lilly, his research, and his sort of philosophy.
Yeah.
And I had no idea.
It apparently gets really psychedelic as it continues. Mm-hmm. I only ever played the first level, so I have a very surface level understanding of Echo the Dolphin.
I think it's something, Joe said it was something to the effect that there's even an alien sort of overmind that causes the events on Earth that make Echo the Dolphin have to try to, you know, go through this gamut of psychedelic levels in order to save the world.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
So at CRI, we continue to see him doing what he's always done. He's using the best technology, various methodologies in an attempt to achieve his goal here. So, for instance, he uses state-of-the-art code-breaking computers in an attempt to crack the code of dolphin vocalization patterns. And as Bruce Clark points out in his Communication Plus One paper from 2014, John Lilly, The Mind of the Dolphin and Communication Out of Bounds, he says Lilly mobilized the best available tools, a cutting-edge array of cybernetic concepts in pursuit of his breakthrough communication with dolphins. He employed, quote, information theory bound up with first-order cybernetics and operated with the heuristic computational metaphors alongside the actual computers of his era.
So that actually speaks to my question from earlier about brain-computer interfaces. Mm-hmm. It sounds like he did have quite a bit of influence on BCI.
Yeah, it sounds like he did. Yeah, he was, you know, basically any area he applied himself to, he managed to influence that discipline.
Wow.
Sometimes in a positive direction, sometimes in a negative direction as well, as we'll discuss. But in all of this too, we're getting into this problem of projection, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. You mean like actual vocal projection?
No. Actual like projecting. Well, maybe to a certain extent, but also. Projecting your consciousness onto another creature.
Oh, okay. Okay.
As Clark points out in his paper, projection short circuits a proper understanding of what others are thinking or meaning to convey when they make a communicative offer. So that, in projection goes, it's a problem when we just try and communicate with each other.
Oh, yeah.
Like I'm not communicating solely with you. I'm communicating with a version of you I have in my mind, my expectations of you, and then the kind of feedback you provide as well.
It's the inherent problem of human communication. Yeah.
Right.
And through a series of feedback and feed forward, we try to clear up like various psychological noise that gets in the middle there of our understanding of what one another are saying. But yeah, it's kind of like the human dilemma, right? Is that like we're never going to fully be able to, at least, you know, with just our voices, communicate what's going on inside our head to one another.
Yeah.
Lilly really wanted to get past that.
Yeah. But one of the problems, of course, is that he despite his scientific background and all of the vigor he's throwing into this, seems to always be working with the certainty that communication can truly be established. And that not only is he reaching out, but they're reaching out to us. He said, quote, "We must keep the working hypothesis in mind that they are highly intelligent and are just as interested in communicating with us as we are with them." So, yeah. You know, that's a potential stumbling block to your efforts here, because you already have it firmly established in your mind that this can be done, that this connection is there to be made.
Yeah.
I mean, and again, the intelligence of dolphins isn't in doubt, but to work with that kind of certainty, with the kind of certainty that they reflect our desire to communicate as well, that's problematic.
Yeah, and certainly I can imagine where that is where he starts to have stumbling blocks with funders, like the Navy, for instance, or the Air Force, or just any, like, even NIM, right? Like, when you start postulating that your test subjects are on an equal playing field with humanity and should be treated as such, that's going to be immediately problematic for them, right? Because it's outside of their world understanding, but it also doesn't fit their agenda.
Yeah, and word of these experiments and some of his methods and ideas, they're leaking out. He has some researchers that are leaving him and working exclusively for the Navy, perhaps whispering about his excessive use of the isolation tank.
Maybe, yeah.
Perhaps they even know something about the LSD. And they're definitely talking about the flooded dolphin cohabitation apartment that becomes a major project toward the end of CRI.
Wait, so
lifespan.
This is, I don't know about this particularly, but I know that he pitched an idea that basically there needed to be some kind of living space that humans and dolphins could coexist within to communicate. Is this his attempt at that?
Yeah, and a lot of credit has to go to scientist Margaret Howe Lovett, who was actually the woman who lived with the dolphins. And she later wrote a book. There were a number of articles that came out about her experience. There's a great Guardian article actually titled "The Dolphin Who Loved Me."
Okay.
And she comes up to the Lilly with the idea. Like, she's already researching dolphins, so she's drawn to his activities here. And according to her in the Guardian piece, she says, "Maybe it was because I was living so close to the lab. It just seemed so simple. Why let the water get in the way? So I said to John Lilly, I want to plaster everything and fill this place with water. I want to live here."
Huh.
So
what, did she have a scuba suit on, or was it just was a shallow enough that she could wade around in it?
Basically, they waterproofed this whole living area. They made a floodable apartment.
Okay.
So that she could live there with the dolphin.
Oh.
For months. Eventually, I think they talked about it being a 3-month period, but it ended up being a 6-month period where she was living with this dolphin, handpicked dolphin named Peter, in an attempt to teach him English. She was going to teach him to speak English.
Okay.
And the idea here in, that Lily, bought into too was that she would be there just constantly as this kind of mother figure, that they would have this chance to bond in a way that human and dolphin had not previously.
And I'm assuming that, like, she must have approached this, like, linguistic effort, I guess, like using the same basis for which we teach young humans language, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding. Yeah, okay. Very much it was like an adult human attempting to teach a child human how to speak.
Okay.
With some added complications that end up being important later on in that they help to scandalize the work here.
Right.
But dolphins can be pretty sexual creatures. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've heard tons of stories.
Yeah. This is probably where a lot of people are familiar with this story.
Okay.
Because she would occasionally have to, help dispense Peter of his sexual urges, let's say, in order to keep the work going.
Okay.
And she says that's the way she approached it. And not from a sexual, vantage point, but this is a part of how Peter behaves as a dolphin.
Uh-huh.
And we need to just sort of get that out of the way so we can continue working on language.
Okay. Well, yeah, I could see why that would be quite scandalous. It's one thing to posit that a dolphin is on a sort of, equal identity status, individualistic status with a human being. It's another thing to start engaging with them, what people would consider bestiality.
Yeah, you get into a weird area here where you have to sort of explain yourself out of that, or attempt to explain yourself out of that to your backers. Or by 1975, actually, Hustler magazine comes out with an article about it,
that didn't help.
Oh yeah, they completely scandalized Lovett in it and the experiment. They had some sort of a provocative illustration and just made it sound like Lovett and Lily were just engaged in a pan species free for all there or something.
Weird.
Criticisms of this experiment aside, clearly wasn't the point. They were trying to teach this creature to speak English. They were trying to bridge this gap between the species but it did get into some pretty weird areas.
This sounds like another, we should add this to our little document of ideas. This sounds like a great thing that we should cover for a future episode is like how much animal sexuality gets in the way of human animal experimentation. This can't be the first time or only time that's happened.
Yeah, or the last.
Right.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you, here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you on our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have like one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So by autumn of 1966, Lily is increasingly more interested in LSD research than the ongoing dolphin research. You know, you could say that he's probably spent more time in the tank with the LSD. The LSD becomes the thing that is holding his interest and seems to be the next logical place for his interest in consciousness to really focus.
Yeah, and to keep it in perspective, he's kind of getting up to sort of retirement age at this point, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, I mean, I should say so. And so it's at this point, just as 6 months of cohabitation with Peter are coming to an end, funding dries up at CRI, and its closure is announced. And they didn't even have a peer-reviewed paper out yet. Again, this comes on the back of rumors that are spreading about the experiments at CRI. Apparently, a visiting board of grant examiners also came and ended up giving just a scathing review of the operation.
Yeah.
And Lily charges that the Navy researchers effectively sabotaged him in all of this. And, you know, maybe they did.
Yeah. And there's that sort of like, this is a question that I had along, like, basically the whole journey for Lily is like, where's the money coming from, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he obviously has that point where he's working very closely with the government and the military. And then he gets into this phase where they're co-funding stuff, but he's also got private resources, possibly even from his family.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can imagine that if they're like coming by to take a tour or something like that, they're probably a little bit horrified.
Well, it seems to be one of those cases where the establishment, if you will, were certainly fine funding Lily as long as his obsessions matched up with their goals and with
right.
their interests.
Yeah.
But as his obsession drifted out of sync with theirs, they stepped away from him.
Well, it's fascinating, but it gets back to what we talked about in the Animals as Weapons episode, right? Like 9 times out of 10, that's where the money comes for this kind of stuff.
Yeah. So CRI is just completely taken apart. The dolphins are, most of the dolphins are apparently released, though Peter apparently, unfortunately, dies in captivity later on. Lily told Lovett that Peter died via suicide, that since dolphins have to consciously breathe, that if a dolphin is significantly upset, it may just simply shut down and stop breathing. And that is allegedly what happened.
And that it was upset by the severing of its bond with Lovett?
Perhaps. That's what Lovett... that's what Lovett says in her book and in the interviews. Yeah.
See, so this is a little bit different from what I had read. And this is by Lily's own account later on. He sort of defiantly goes on later on to say, like, he, in the face of the Navy and everybody else, he purposely let all the dolphins go. And he even said to the point, he said, well, they were finished reprogramming me. So, he, you know, obviously like went to the, far into the metaphor where the dolphins were performing the experiment on him. He wasn't experimenting on them.
Right.
And that they chose to let him go.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, at this point, we really reach the point where, Lily begins to fall out of favor with a lot of folks. Certainly by the time that, Hustler magazine, article comes out in 75, as pointed out in that Orion magazine piece, A Mind in the Water, that I mentioned earlier, Lily went on to just be widely reviled by professional dolphin researchers. And working scientists have for some time tended to dismiss him as just a lunatic, you know, as this hippie nut job. And you can understand that, right? I mean, you're trying to do this serious professional work, and his figure is sort of looming in your peripheral vision the whole time. People were perhaps bringing him up. He's tarnished your work and your passions to a certain extent by his approach to tackling them.
Well, especially knowing how competitive and sort of vicious, unfortunately, that like academic and research competition can kind of go. Yeah, I'm not surprised at all that sort of like the next generation of dolphin researchers turned on him. Although it, you know, it also does sound like he wasn't exactly producing, I guess, like documented results, right? The kind of things that were being looked for, both for the funding, but also to justify, you know, what he was doing.
Exactly.
Well, I also heard that, and I'm curious if this is still true. This is from around the time, right before he died. Apparently, the research station was going to be converted into a luxury condo living center that was called Dolphin Cove.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I wonder if Dolphin Cove is still there. It's St. Thomas, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Curious.
Yeah. I'd love to hear from
if you can go
out there
visit it. I wonder if the underwater apartment is still there. You pay $300 a night to stay, and, there's no dolphin. You just, you know,
you just walk around
sleep
the water,
on a bed underwater. Time. Yeah. So, okay, this is really like the final, I guess, stage of Lily's, research career, as it were. And he kind of goes whole hog into the LSD field, right?
Right. And this is pretty much the path he continues for the rest of his life, really. This is where, this is where Lily truly becomes the coonskin cap wearing, psychonaut. Counterculture mythic figure.
This is when he gets his membership card into the Psychedelic Avengers.
Oh, right.
That we've been talking about on our episodes for quite
for
some time.
For
He's
certain.
Officially a part of the team now. And I'd seen photos of him hanging out with Timothy Leary and Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, during this stage, he apparently continues a certain degree of dolphin research. Some of it is more is on the scientific side, like the use of musical tones. Mm-hmm. Some of it is more far more mystical, such as the looking into telepathy. But the dolphin continues to be kind of a mascot for him and for his work. So even though the CRI center is gone, the dolphin still remains an important part of Lily's life. But of course, so does LSD and the use of LSD and other psychoactive agents to still crack that nut of consciousness in human existence and reach that providence of the mind.
And one of my understandings is that like once LSD became illegal, he sort of moved into other psychotropics. Specifically, ketamine was one that he used a lot. And wrote about a lot as well.
Yes, indeed. And if his writings are in any indication, and he wrote a lot about his experiences using LSD. Like the times he used it, he really used it. Like he went in whole hog. He had access, legitimate access to pharmaceutical grade LSD 25 and really attempted to just break through to the other side with it.
And this was one of the actual like primary resources you were able to get a hold of for this episode, right? One of his books specifically about these experiences. What's it called?
It's called Programming and Metaprogramming in the Human Biocomputer.
Okay. So this is just kind of his like lab notes of taking LSD?
Essentially, it's his big book of LSD observations published in 1972. And it's, God, it's a very interesting book to read.
Yeah.
It's a difficult book to read as well. A lot of Lily's writing
on this sort of thing, it seems to be a fascinating synthesis of converging disciplines. So he's dealing with mysticism and New Age thought. He's also using a lot of computer programming terminology and computer programming metaphors, as is evidence in the title.
Yeah, and that goes back to when he was talking about the dolphins at the end of it, too. He said they reprogrammed him.
Right.
Okay.
And then there's a lot of psychoanalysis in there as well. Like any discipline he's picked up, any technology he's picked up,
yeah,
it goes into this writing. And at times there's almost a stream of consciousness quality to the writings,
yeah,
as if all three of these interpretive systems are working at the same time in different ways, and Lilly is just sharing his thoughts in real time. And this can be at times alluring. It can be rather alienating. There are portions of programming the human computer that read like the stuffiest trip guide you could possibly imagine.
I can sort of imagine, especially because, right, like he was beholden to no one. He's just kind of writing. Yeah. I mean, if it was present day, he'd be publishing Kindle ebooks or something like that, right? But like, isn't there still like a trust or something like that manages his publishing endeavors?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, all his books are still out there in one form or another. But, you know, even though at times they're stuffy, there are other times where it does just read like pure, psychonaut poetry. You know, he's taking all of this, these tools, and he's trying to, you know, figure out what the self is, what consciousness is, what are the limits of consciousness. At times it's beautiful, and at times it's very difficult and alienating.
And so this gets us into the Lilly phase that I have the hardest time identifying with. Up until this point, I'm on board. You know, I'm interested in what he's doing. I'm interested in his findings, even when it comes to like, you know, masturbating a dolphin and taking LSD to try to telepathically communicate with them. Like I'm interested. Mm-hmm. But then we get into, I guess it's the Echo phase. This is where, by the way, like connected to the Echo the Dolphin video game, it's not Echo, ECHO, it's ECCO because it's an acronym.
Oh, yes. Earth Coincidence Control Office. Yeah. So, this ends up coming about in the 70s, really. But you see the roots of it back as far as 1962. Okay. Because with his counterculture celebrity status, he attracted a lot of peers, followers, hangers-on from all corners, including some of the day's most brilliant free-thinking minds, such as a young Carl Sagan, for instance.
Interesting. Okay.
And by 62, he'd organized the Order of the Dolphin and served as Grand Dolphin. And it's important to note that this was – I kind of think of this as kind of like it's kind of like a Tool album. It's serious, but it's also not that serious.
Yeah, it feels like performance art to me.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of performance art. There's a certain amount of goofery, but then there are also some serious undertones as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this involves astrophysicists, radio astronomers, atmospheric chemists, computer engineers, and they even apparently have special pins that they would wear.
Oh, man. Can you imagine if we could get a hold of some of those pins?
That
they'd
would
probably
be
go for a pretty penny on eBay.
Yeah, sir. Someone will sell one to me.
Or one of his hats, one of his coonskin hats.
Yeah, it was apparently a little engraved dolphin. Now, eventually, a lot of his more sci-fi-oriented ideas come out of this period as well.
Yeah. And again, like, I'm not 100% sure that Lilly actually believed this stuff, right? I think we need to cover it in order to sort of get the full Lilly picture here.
Right.
But I get the feeling that this is sort of him, like, yeah, performance art, maybe creating like living metaphors in order to somehow communicate his ideas out to people, right? Like the more absurd and spectacular the idea, the more attention it's possibly going to get.
Yeah, I mean, a literal interpretation of some of these things that we're talking about here, of his later ideas in writing, it seems a bit too simple for such a complex individual, especially when we look to what Lilly himself wrote about his early writings, in particular in the 1972 forward to a reprint of Programming and Metaprogramming in the Human Biocomputer. He said, "I had written the report in such a way that its basic messages were hidden behind a heavy, long introduction designed to stop the casual reader. Apparently, once word got out, this device no longer stalled the interested readers. Somehow the basic messages were important enough to enough readers so that the work acquired an unexpected viability." So he's already talking at that stage about a kind of coded nature to his work,
mm-hmm,
that he's hiding ideas, that he's layering these ideas. So it seems, yeah, in light of that, it seems a bit counterintuitive to say that, for instance, when he's talking about the threat of a solid state intelligence, that he's speaking literally.
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember, back up, like, this is a guy whose whole purpose in life was human consciousness and connecting human consciousness to other consciousnesses, mm-hmm. right? And language, he's fully aware that language is the best way that we're doing that now and the ways to manipulate it in order to sort of best, I guess you could almost look at it as a like tool of rhetoric, right?
Yeah.
In order for him to get his ideas across. But yeah, let's back up with like the solid state and the echo stuff. So this is pretty out there. Like he posits that there's like an alien intelligence that's kind of in control of everything, right?
Yeah, this is where we get into that, into this idea that there's a hierarchy of coincidence control offices at the Earth level, solar level, galactic, and cosmic. So again, that's where we get down to Echo, right?
Yeah.
Earth coincidence control offices. And these are essentially serving the same purpose of God as a controlling intelligence in the universe. So this is, really, this is Lily turning to notions of spirituality, really thinking about God and putting his own spin on what God would be in his worldview.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not that far off from like other, I'm thinking like Philip K. Dick, for instance.
Yeah, definitely.
Like he's writing around the same period of time. So it's not that far off. I can imagine that Lily would maybe pick up something like Valis and be like, okay, maybe this is a cool idea for me to get my ideas of consciousness across now that the Navy's pulled my funding.
Yeah, he also, as I alluded to earlier, he prophesized a future conflict between organic intelligence and machine intelligence, which he referred to as the solid state intelligence or SSI. So specifically, he said this would be a conflict over ideal environmental conditions for either humans or the sort of SSI created bioforms that crave cold and vacuums. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, and then along this period of time too is when he envisions what I was telling you about earlier, which I thought was where the apartment thing was going, mm-hmm. but he called it the Future Communications Laboratory and he called it a floating living room. And the idea was that this is where humans and dolphins would come to connect. So I'm imagining something like along the lines of like a SeaWorld type thing that's less, imprisoning to the dolphins, right? Where the right. dolphins can kind of come up and interact with human beings. And so that idea is like along those same lines, I guess. But we have to remember too, like 1972, the same time he's getting into this real weird stuff, Lily's pivotal to establishing the Marine Mammal Protection Act within the United States government. You know, I mean, he's grounded. He's actually affecting change in how human beings are connecting with dolphins, but he's also, you know, experimenting with some of this other stuff. Yeah, I have to say, just like backing up and looking at the big picture here, I think he was having a laugh, you know, or maybe just trying to use some really out there ideas in order to draw attention to his more grounded philosophy.
Yeah, he's more of a mystical philosopher, dreamer, and to a certain extent, trickster. You can't wear a coonskin cap like right. that and expect to be taken 100% seriously. You're kind of winking at the audience at that point. But to your point, yeah, he was a major proponent of not only the intelligence and value of dolphins but their and whales but their rights as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he believed that killing whales and dolphins was as immoral as killing other human beings, and they should be protected by law, and humans should understand them as sentient beings. This is one of the big quotes that I saw pop up from him over and over and over again about dolphins. He said, "They are not someone to kill, but someone to learn from." And I think you see that in at least we're not quite there yet, obviously, but I mean, like, think of all of the protests over the last couple decades about like dolphins getting killed in tuna traps, right? Like that kind of, thought about dolphins would not have been possible without Lily.
Indeed. So there you have it. John C. Lilly, hopefully a much more complete picture of the man and his work, his seriousness, his madness, his imagination, and his just, you know, intense, hyper-focused intellect. Certainly more so than we've been able to do in previous episodes.
Yeah. So, you know, I would love to hear from people out there who have maybe got some, because it seems like there's just such a wide array of resources about Lily. Is there something that we missed here, or is there more to the story? Maybe you know something about Echo that we don't know. Maybe you've been in touch with the solid state intelligence. You know, you can talk to us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. We're on all those platforms. And of course, the best way to get in touch with us is directly at our email address, which is blowthemind@howstuffworks.com. Now, most of you are used to the show ending right there. We usually end it right after .com, but we're going to end a little differently today, right, Robert? You found a particular gem that we're going to add to the episode.
That's right. We're going to close it out with the art department track, The Agent, off of the 2014 album Natural Selection from Number 19 Music. There, NO19 Music on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. This is a really cool track, and it includes samples from John C. Lilly's lecture, Through the Center of the Mandala.
One problem in human existence is the tendency to repeat. Repeat. Again and again and again. In the same kind of looping cycle. It is as if one is controlled.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.